It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In the fall of 1993, the Bouncing Baby Food Network hit the airwaves for the first time. At the time, some culture watchers found it a little out there. A whole network about people cooking food? Come on.
But the Food Network beams its food content into 100 million homes these days and launched the careers of celebrity chefs like Rachel Ray and Emeril Lagasse. And joining us now with a scoop on the Food Network is Alan Sulkin. He's the author of From Scratch, Inside the Food Network. Alan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. Thrilled to be here.
Well, so in 1993, watching people cook stuff in prime time seemed a little out there. What was the response?
Well, there was only 6.5 million houses right then getting it, and the response was basically, thankfully, a resounding silence, because a lot of what they were putting on the air was so awful.
What was wrong with it? What were they doing wrong when they first started it off?
Well, if you remember back in the early 90s, there was only about 25, maybe 30 cable channels, and everybody knew that there was going to be this the coming 500-channel universe, basically the world we live in now, which is then now rapidly becoming the 5-jillion-channel universe. But back then, they were just looking for ideas to start channels. And so these guys in Providence, Rhode Island, who worked for the cable company, who weren't even into food, just thought food would be a good business play. And they attracted investors and eventually started this network in a rush because they were worried that somebody else would get the idea. So, you know, one of the first shows was a talk show with Robin Leach from Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Wow, that sounds really random now compared to what the lineup is. I mean, what else was on there?
Well, there was a daily news show, which actually was sort of a precursor to The Chew. It just took 20 years to get it right, and this was originally called Food News and Views, and it had a great food guy, but not a great TV guy, named David Rosengarten. And it had, and his co-host was Donna Hanover, then Donna Hanover Giuliani, the First Lady of New York. So it was a pretty random, assemblage of programming. And Emeril Lagasse, who of course founded the best early show that got them on the map years later, Emeril Live, was on his first show, which was called How to Boil Water. The founding president of the network was a guy named Rhys Schoenfeld, who had also founded CNN. And Rhys did not even have a kitchen. He and his wife had the kitchen removed. This is an only in New York kind of thing. They'd had their kitchen removed so they could fit dog food and a coffee maker, basically, and more shoes. So anyway, Rhys had a friend who was getting divorced, and that guy said, well, what we really need is a show to teach the basics. So Emeril Lagasse's first show was literally pour water in pot, turn on heat, make sure pilot light is lit.
So that was, you know, sort of the early days of, you know, of cooking on TV. Is it something that was just sort of confined to public television back then?
That's right. Back then, it was sort of the food TV ghetto was the weekend mornings on public television. Even there was producers who were pitching to public TV and saying, you know, there's a lot of hunger for this, but the executives there were very elitist and just believed it belonged in the mornings and, you know, said things, sorry, public radio, but said that, you know, we are the network of Nova and the NewsHour. You know, we have quite enough cooking. But the big stars then were actually the frugal gourmet, Jeff Smith, who unfortunately fell on hard times towards the end of his life, and Martin Yan, and of course, whatever reruns they were running of the great Julia Child. And so, you know, the opportunity to, the idea that anyone would even want to watch this stuff in prime time was viewed very skeptically by a lot of investors and by a lot of people.
Now, Emeril has not made it through to the present-day Food Network, but as you said, he was sort of one of these very first early stars, and I want us to take a listen to what it was like. This is Emeril Live.
All right! So the question is, how's everybody in Chicago doing tonight? Emeril Lagasse here. Want to let you guys at home on a little secret. The real reason that people come to Chicago is for the food.
Yeah.
It's not those cows on the street there, Mom. Tonight I'm cooking up some Chicago favorites, such as an incredible Chicago-style Italian sausage and pepper deep dish pizza.
Yeah! Oh, yeah.
Rhoda's over here going, Some classic Chicago hot dogs, and then I'm going to kick it up notches unknown to mankind with a killer porterhouse steak served with an overstuffed baked potato.
And Emeril's always kicking it up a notch, isn't he? That was sort of his tagline. And one of the things watching this clip, you know, I've seen Emeril before, but I was really struck by the people in the audience. Yeah. They were like, it was like seeing the Beatles, kind of. I mean, these people were going nuts for Emeril.
It was, it was a lot like seeing the Beatles. And it was actually even recorded not far from the Ed Sullivan Theater in New York, where the Beatles made their first American appearance. Yes, the crowd, listen to that crowd. Emeril, it was the Tonight Show, you know, meets a cooking show, and he was spreading news that people did not know before in America. The great food was sort of confined to these urban areas, maybe Berkeley, Los Angeles, downtown New York. I mean, obviously there was interesting food being cooked, you know, in a lot of ethnic enclaves everywhere, even Wisconsin. But for the most part, this sort of new American cuisine was limited, and it was the Food Network which kind of discovered this nascent American food scene and then presented it to the masses. And it allowed it to spread, you know, to the point now where there's a Food Network kiosk at Lambeau Field, you know, serving more than hot dogs, and you know, more even stadium food is better. And by the time that Emeril show started, the network had finally, you know, broken through to about 20, 30 million homes of being carried. So, you know, there was enough people getting it so that when they saw it, they got excited. And one last thing, the crowd, a lot of children were bringing their parents there because it was children who were finding this amazing character in Emeril and were very excited by him, just like the kids sort of led the rest of us to rock and roll way back when.
Well, it sounds like the thing you were describing as missing in those early shows was the showmanship, the yeah. fun of it. Was there a conscious decision, like, we've got to make a zany production out of this instead of just, you know, having people talk about food?
Well, if you read in the book, it was really an evolution, and they were worried about losing Emeril. They had some bad shows with Emeril, and they had one that was pretty good, which was his third show, Essence of Emeril. And because of the success of that, they were worried. He was the best star they had. And it was actually this sort of accidental thing that he had a cookbook coming out called Real and Rustic. And they just, this one guy who, the secret hero of the book is a guy named Joe Langan, who really founded the Food Network, started the website, and thought up Emeril Live. And they just needed to produce a special for the Real and Rustic book to make Emeril happy. And it was Joe's idea to have a live audience. And so when Emeril rushed out the first time and sort of played with a chicken and the crowd went absolutely nuts, everybody who was in that room at the time describes these shivers that ran down their spine knowing they had a hit there.
You know, it's interesting because for something as benign as cooking, the Food Network has really had its share of sort of scandals and drama over the years. And there's your book is full of so many great stories. I wonder if you could tell us one or two before our news break.
Well, I mean, the most recently, obviously, Paula Deen. But then you can go back to the guy that they thought was going to be the new Emeril, a guy named David Ruggiero. After his first show was on the air, unfortunately, the New York district attorney arrested him for credit card fraud. They were his restaurant was putting like $100,000 on rich guys' credit cards. And there was a guy, Juan Carlos, I'm blanking on his name, but the Calorie Commando, and he was arrested for putting a hit out on his wife. And that's just the sort of criminal scandals and drama. There's also all these dramas about people who wanted their shows to continue and were thought to have big egos but were cut off, and the drama of all the new presidents who came and all the different owners of the Food Network, and who survived and who did not survive. And you'll see in the book that the great survivor is Bobby Flay. He's the one who was able to adapt to all of the crazy circumstances. I don't want to talk over your news break, though.
That's okay. And we'll get back to him, talk more about Bobby Flay and Paula Deen and Rachel Ray. Hopefully we'll get to her as well. As we talk about the Food Network right now, we're talking to Alan Sulkin, and he's the author of From Scratch, Inside the Food Network.
We want to hear from you. Why do you think the Food Network has been such a hit? Why do we like to watch people cook stuff on the TV? Call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Do you watch the TV cooks? Do you try to do what they do, or is it just good, clean fun? You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're talking about the creation of the Food Network, the rise of the celebrity chef. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Were you a big fan? Are you a big fan of any of the Food Network chefs? Do you like watching cooking? 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
Alan Sulkin is with us now. He's the author of From Scratch, Inside the Food Network. And Alan, you mentioned Paula Deen. And, you know, of course, most recently, she is famous for sort of getting thrown off the Food Network after she used some racially sensitive language. But before that, she was sort of known as the Queen of Butter. Let's take a listen to a little bit of her old show.
What I'm fixing to do is fry up the Lady and Sons macaroni and cheese. I'm going to wrap it in bacon, and we're going to deep fry it. So here goes, y'all.
Paula Deen being Paula Deen, and that's what she did back in those days. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what her appeal was and a little bit about her fall from grace and how that happened?
Yeah, and Paula finally got on the air after 9/11. The network made a decision that it was going – Rachel Ray – her show started right after 9/11, and her ratings were so great, they never realized that what people wanted was more comfort food. They didn't need quite as many chefs. They wanted personalities who could appeal to you more like a next-door neighbor giving you cooking tips. And the network had been – executives had been very resistant to Paula, thinking they didn't want this brand of sort of southernness. There was actually a lot of prejudice against the South by these New York executives. But finally, Paula's agent convinced them after 9/11 that people wanted comfort and, you know, fried chicken could fly. So that, you know, she became this sort of, you know, comforting grandma figure on the air, you know, and Giada was sort of like, you know, the girlfriend that you always wish you had, and Ina was like your next-door neighbor aunt or something. So anyway, Paula had that and was always able to get away with being a little kind of risque and in her public appearances, you know, using foul language. Her pants once fell down during an appearance at a festival. She was kind of this wild, like your grandma who curses a lot, you know. It was the diabetes, her announcement that she had diabetes about a year and a half ago that really started her having problems with the Food Network. They hired a crisis communications company to call reporters on the sly and start saying, we had nothing to do with this. Because the fact that she took a $6 million endorsement deal for a diabetes drug, and that's when she's made her announcement that she had diabetes, without ever telling the network she was going to do that. Now, when you listen to that clip, you know, bacon-wrapped, deep-fried macaroni and cheese, it's funny until you realize that, in a way, this is you're watching a woman sort of commit suicide on the air in front of you, and it becomes a lot less fun to, you know, the woman with diabetes making bananas Foster with butter and a cup full of sugar.
And Anthony Bourdain made that critique of her kind of all over the place for a while.
That's right. And, you know, Bourdain, whose first show was on the Food Network, people forget that, has become the cleverest and best and smartest critic of the network properly. So anyway, by the time Paula's N-word scandal, hit the headlines, which was very badly managed by her team, the network basically said she's got two strikes against her. We are now a $6 billion company. We can't be in business with this kind of thing.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Patty with us in Pittsville. Patty, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Personally, I really enjoy the cooking competitions that they have on there, like Chopped. I love seeing ingredients I've never heard of being used and seeing how these chefs can think off the top of their heads. I don't particularly watch the shows that you know, where they do their cooking, like Paula Deen did.
Mm-hmm.
My mother used to enjoy those shows a lot and would take recipes and use them for family get-togethers, but I prefer the challenging ones where you see them competing.
Right. Mm. Thanks a lot, Patty, for the call. So, Alan, is that a case of the Food Network adapting with the times to the rise of reality TV?
Well, it's not just that, Patty. You know, that's why they're putting that stuff on in prime time. The what they call the dump and stir cooking show, the Julia Child format, really is losing ratings, and people are not as interested anymore. But it is important to say, just as she said, even within that competition, you can still learn about, you know, new kinds of ingredients and dragon fruit and even for some people still arugula. So the network is right now, I love Chopped also. However, the problem is besides Chopped and Restaurant Impossible, they haven't got a hell of a lot that's working well in prime time.
And they're kind of late to that party, aren't they? You write about how they didn't really get on board when Top Chef hit the airwaves.
That's right, and for two reasons. They're a company that doesn't really want to take huge chances, and Top Chef was a very expensive production, and Food Network has never been a big fan of going out big. They'll spend money a little later after something hits, but they don't take those kind of gambles.
I see all over regular old network television now lots of cooking competition shows and the swearing chef telling people how to run their restaurant and fix the restaurant and things like that. Is the Food Network falling behind in its own game here?
I think the problem is they've got one foot in that, and then they've got one foot in the fact of who they really are, which is a network that got successful by presenting something comforting. If you go to a gym or a lot of situations where TV is on, it's either going to be ESPN or the Food Network on. It's this common denominator. And, you know, ESPN is just comfort food for a lot of people. And Food Network, the idea of the hearth, of watching somebody make something delicious, I think is their core brand. And the more, you know, swearing chefs they put on, possibly the more trouble they're in.
Well, the Food Network isn't really just about TV anymore. It's become a bit of an empire. These celebrity chefs, they have their own lines of cookware and spices and other shows. And Rachel Ray is a great example of that. And let's listen to a clip of her show.
Oh, look how good this looks, huh? And even if you're just making this for yourself, leftovers are killer, kids. So make a big pot. My dog Boo could always help eat this one, too. She loves spaghetti and meatballs. Look how good that looks. Oh, amazing.
A little bit there from Rachel Ray's show. What can you tell us about her and how she sort of exemplifies this idea of Food Network empire, Alan?
Well, Rachel isn't even making 30-minute meals anymore. That show is, they made so many, they're just putting them on in reruns. And Rachel, actually with her husband, John Cusimano, has been able to lead the way in developing a brand of, you know, knives, everything she saw on the show. People started requesting those things before there were even products, like her spaghetti pot that was long, so you could just lay the spaghetti in it. It sounds so obvious, right? But she invented that, basically. She made that a popular item, the spaghetti pot that you don't have to scrunch the spaghetti down into.
So where do you see the Food Network going from here? Are they going to sink or swim in that pot of boiling spaghetti?
I think what's going to happen, especially as there's more and more places to get programming across the internet and everywhere else, is that the network is going to make more and more money because it is expanding internationally. It has started food networks in South Africa, in Asia, in the UK, and so it's more profitable than ever. It's a company that's making hundreds of millions of dollars a quarter, but its U.S. ratings are slipping. I think ultimately it's going to become more of a niche network, as all the networks are. Everyone is chasing number one, but the reality of the business is probably going to become back what it was going to be 20 years ago, a good, solid niche network with some devoted viewers that's probably ridden the wave of food, the expansion of food culture is almost as far as it can, and it's probably going to subside just like every wave does.
All right. Well, Alan, it's been fun. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's an honor, and thank you very much.
That was Alan Soligan, author of the book From Scratch, Inside the Food Network.
We had Stephen in Lake Geneva online, by the way. He says he hates cooking, but he loves having the cooking shows on in the background. They're great white noise. Well, how about you? You can still share your thoughts at Central Time on WPR.
And you can see Alan Salkin coming up at the Wisconsin Book Festival. You'll want to check out the website for that. And coming up, the federal government has plans to sue North Carolina over its voter ID law. We'll find out how the move could affect the rest of the country. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Later on Central Time, we'll talk with a guest who says it's time to get rid of vanity plates. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
But first, in the wake of a recent Supreme Court decision that struck down parts of the Voting Rights Act, the state of North Carolina passed new laws limiting early voting and requiring voters to present ID at the polls. That's not sitting well with the Obama administration.
So today, in what's being called an effort to protect voting rights, the Department of Justice is filing suit against the state. And our next guest says North Carolina is definitely a state to watch in 2013 and beyond and could become a significant player in the future of the Voting Rights Act and election policy across the nation.
Joining us now is Doug Chapin. He's director of the Program for Excellence in Election Administration for the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. Doug, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, let's set the stage first. Earlier this year, the Supreme Court struck down part of that Voting Rights Act. What got struck down that opened the door for North Carolina to pass these laws?
The Supreme Court ruled in the case Shelby County versus Holder that the formula that's used to choose jurisdictions that are subject to a certain provision of the Voting Rights Act, known as Section 5, was outdated and therefore could not be enforced. So as a result, a bunch of jurisdictions, including the state of North Carolina, that had previously been required to submit their election changes to the federal government for what's called preclearance before they could be enforced, were no longer required to do so. And so many jurisdictions, including North Carolina, in the wake of that decision, have moved to make changes like the ones which are now about to be under suit from the Justice Department.
And the Justice Department is unhappy about a bunch of parts of North Carolina election law. What law? What exactly are they challenging?
Well, a bunch of different things in there. There's the voter ID requirement, which was already a target of preclearance efforts before that part of the act was invalidated by Shelby County. Also, North Carolina had a very active early voting system that started 17 days before Election Day, and then really unique to North Carolina, they employed something that they call one-stop voting, where up until the Sunday before Election Day, a voter was able to go to an early voting site, register to vote, and vote the same day. So unlike a state like Wisconsin, which has same-day registration, that did not exist in North Carolina except for voters who went in and used those one-stop early voting centers. And that was one of the things that was invalidated by the new state law.
There's already been a suit against the state of Texas, right? How is this different?
This is another one a lot like the Texas suit. In the wake of Shelby County, the federal government lost the ability to require states to get preclearance of these election changes. And it really was a very powerful tool because in states covered by Section 5 of the Act, states were not able to enact things like voter ID. And in the wake of Shelby County, Texas and North Carolina and other states have moved forward with ID. And so these lawsuits are part of the Justice Department's effort to reassert the power of the federal government to enforce the Voting Rights Act against these states using a slightly different piece of the Voting Rights Act.
The Voting Rights Act applied to just a handful of states you mentioned, mostly in the South, mostly during the civil rights era. Does any of this affect states that weren't covered by the act?
It could potentially. The part that got struck down in Shelby County, as you pointed out, was largely focused on southern states, not uniformly, but largely. That's Section 5, which required states to get preclearance in advance. There's another section of the Voting Rights Act called Section 2, which is enforceable nationwide. And that's when a plaintiff, including the federal government, can bring suit alleging that an election law has discriminatory impact against protected minority voters. And so what the Justice Department is doing in Texas and in North Carolina is using Section 2 as a way to go after these laws that they are now unable to block using Section 5. The other thing that's interesting in both of these cases is that the Justice Department is asking the court also to use Section 3 of the Act, which is known as the bail-in requirement, that rather than jurisdictions being able to bail out because of good behavior, the federal government can ask a court to bail a jurisdiction in and resubject them to preclearance under the Voting Rights Act. And since that would be under a different section than the one that the Supreme Court invalidated in Shelby County, those states from then on would be required to pre-clear their voting changes again. So this really is right at the cutting edge in this battle between states and the federal government, between supporters and opponents of the Voting Rights Act, about what the act will mean in 2013 and beyond.
Well, let's key in on the voter ID part of it. That's been an ongoing battle in Wisconsin and a number of other states as well. Is there this argument all over the country as to whether or not there is a civil rights angle to voter ID?
Well, there is. I mean, there is often, in fact, almost always, when you have a challenge to voter ID requirements, whether by opponents of a law in the legislature or by plaintiffs once a law is passed and enacted, invariably it involves some civil rights angle. There is an argument that voters, that racial minority voters, younger voters, older voters have less access to or don't have the ID that's required to cast a ballot, and that therefore requiring them to have that ID will work a civil rights violation. And what's going to be interesting in these cases in Texas and North Carolina is that the Justice Department is going to have to put on evidence that that's actually the case, that there are people who are otherwise eligible to vote who will not be able to do so because of voter ID requirements, and that they will be disproportionately represented by racial minorities and other folks protected by the act.
Is that going to be a tall order for them to be able to make that case, do you think?
I think it's going to be a challenge. I think one of the interesting things about the voter ID debate across the country is that really neither side has a whole lot of proof to back up their claims. Supporters of voter ID talk a lot about fraud, and as we've seen time and time again, there's very little evidence that there are actually people pretending to be other people to cast ballots. But really, on the other side, these claims that large numbers of voters will be disenfranchised by the ID requirement hasn't been backed up by numbers. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't folks out there who don't have ID, who aren't able to vote. But to date, we haven't seen a lot of really good empirical studies of how ID requirements will affect real voters in real elections rather than sort of hypothetical voters in legal arguments.
Both sides of this debate get accused of, I guess, a political cynicism here. People accuse Republicans of supporting voter ID because it makes it harder for people who don't vote Republican to vote. Democrats get accused of being on the other side because they want to make it easier for people to vote Democratic to vote. Do you think there's that sort of cynical political motivation on either side?
Well, I mean, it's certainly, you can look at the facts. That's one conclusion you can come to. Another one, which I think is just as likely, if not more so, is that this is just yet another issue on which the parties have very divergent views. If I were to tell you that, you know, someone was going to walk through the door and they opposed voter ID, you would assume they were a Democrat. I don't think people always oppose voter ID because they're Democrats. They might be a Democrat because they oppose voter ID. And similarly, Republicans who, you know, believe in the integrity of institutions and talk about, you know, order and the like are more likely to support ID. So while there is definitely a kind of cynical political spin you can put on this debate, I think it's also the product of a very real policy difference between the parties, which mirrors differences on everything, you know, from reproductive rights to the budget to you name it on other issues. So whatever the reason, it's a white hot debate, and it's going to be battled out in courts in Texas and North Carolina and probably other states in the foreseeable future.
I was going to say, are there other shoes you expect to drop, and if so, where?
Well, I think there were lawsuits under preclearance in places like South Carolina. I know there's been an issue of whether or not the state of Florida is going to crank up their voter purge or voter maintenance process again. The state of Mississippi has enacted a voter ID law and is working its way toward implementing it. I think that if you see other jurisdictions moving toward voter ID or other what are perceived as rollbacks on voting rights, I think you might see the Justice Department or other plaintiffs bringing suit. But I think Texas and North Carolina in many ways are going to be a test case, both for people who support the act and want to see it reinforced, but also for people who oppose the act and are going to claim that DOJ is once again overreaching on these and that requiring states to be bailed back into preclearance is just as far over the line as those sections of the act that were invalidated under the Shelby County case. Really a fascinating case for voting rights lawyers, and I think one that'll be worth watching as we roll toward the elections in both 2014 and 2016.
We will watch that. Doug, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Doug Chapin. He's an election expert at the University of Minnesota.
Coming up next, you might have fun reading them on the road, but our next guest says get rid of them. He'll make the case for scrapping vanity plates right after the break.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You see them all over the road. Some are funny, some are serious, some just don't make any sense. Vanity plates run the gamut. And we did a quick Google search, came up with things like pug lover and bacon. But there's lots of others that test the limit of what's acceptable to the government.
That's part of the problem, according to our next guest. He says vanity plates ultimately aren't worth the constitutional and financial burdens they create.
Danny Savalas joins us now. He's an attorney at Savalas & Wong, LLP, and a legal analyst for CNN. His op-ed on getting rid of vanity plates appeared on CNN.com. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Danny, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
All right, so let's just get it out there. Vanity plates are kind of fun, so what do you see as the problem here?
Oh, I don't want to be seen as a stick in the mud. I think they're hilarious. I think they're a riot, and I like the ones that push the envelope. The more they push the envelope, I think it's entertaining to see what crazy things they get past the reviewers. Frankly, I would like to see the conference room where the people, the officials who review these license plates do it, because they seem to miss as many as they catch. I mean, there has been tons of litigation. So the bottom line is my entertainment is important to me, but ultimately, if I think globally about the state as about public policy and about what we spend our limited resources on, maybe vanity plates day has come and gone. I mean, maybe in the 50s and 60s and 70s, that was the one way to sort of express yourself. But my goodness, we've got Twitter, we've got Instagram, we've got a lot of different ways to express ourselves. The bottom line is that all this litigation, while I find it entertaining, and if you just Google, like you guys did, vanity plates, you named some of the tamer ones. Look at some of the rejected ones, and you'll laugh out of your cubicle wherever you are. The bottom line is, should we really be expending our government resources on, for even if it's $30 that we're generating from, the government's generating from its citizens, should we really be doing that if it involves hiring people to have to review license plates, to turn them down, and then spend a lot of money on lawyers and courts to litigate, you know, whether or not different words are acceptable?
Well, let's get into that now. I mean, Packers, great. F-word, bad. Where's the gray area that we start to see legal challenges and fuzziness for the license plate censors?
Great way of looking at it, but legally it's even less clear, because the problem with a law, remember, this isn't talking about what can you stencil onto the back of your car. Everyone has seen all manner of gothic lettering with all kinds of things on bumper stickers, on windows. I mean, that's a separate issue. That's your private choice. That's free speech. The real problem is that the government is involved with this speech. And essentially, the government is renting out space for you to say something, to speak on something that's essentially their property, which is a license plate. So the question isn't necessarily what can't you say on TV or what you can't you say out loud. The Supreme Court has said you can say you can stencil the F word onto your jacket and walk around in public. So that's not really an issue. The issue is if the government is going to rent out its property for you to speak on, do they have the right to censor it? And the Constitution provides that laws or schemes that allow for the government to have too much discretion or that are constitutionally vague. In other words, if I were to ask you, can you come up, each of you separately, and if I closed you off and separated you, put you in different rooms and said, you tell me your top 20 most offensive words that cannot appear on a license plate. Do you think, even you two probably have worked together for some time, do you think you'd even come close to the same? You'd have a lot of the...
That'd be a fun exercise. Word. We'll do it later.
You'd have the basics. You'd have the biggies, the hits. You'd have, the F word, the S word, all the seven deadly words you can't say on TV. But once you get out to about 18, 19, 20, I would hazard a guess that you two would be completely polar opposites of each other,
and I guess
that therein is the constitutional problem. If a law doesn't provide fair notice to its citizens what speech is okay and what is not, then it's constitutionally vague.
And in your piece, you talk in specific about an example where a former military guy wanted to put the word infidel on his plates, and he managed to get through lots of the, roadblocks, but at the very end, someone flagged it and it couldn't go up.
I mean, can you imagine what's going on at a government building where actual real business is supposed to be going on? This guy makes an application for not the word infidel, because he had to shorten it one letter to infidel without the ending E, and then that wasn't available. And candidly, we don't know if that was, this isn't my client, and I just don't know whether or not that was taken or already rejected. And then ultimately, he changes the second I in infidel to a number one. And my argument in my column and in general is this: once you start getting into that substituting numbers for letters, I mean, now we're not even talking about a word anymore. We're talking about your brain having to intentionally make a mistake and read a one as a letter I.
That's what's fun about it, though.
Yeah,
you're on your road trips and you have to figure out what people are saying.
Absolutely.
I don't know.
I agree. Yeah, I think it's a blast. Believe me. And I've told you, I love when people sneak by. I'm a bit of an anarchist when it comes to the license plates. I think it's entertaining, but thinking globally, thinking about our government and our resources, just because I'm entertained by it doesn't mean it's a good practice. Look, the government's already involved in other sorts of money grabs, the lottery, things like that. I mean, when it comes to a money grab, the real question ultimately is the fact that I enjoy license plates doesn't matter. And I'm going to say something too that's going to be controversial, but I think the sergeant who applied for this would agree with me. It really shouldn't matter, unfortunately, whether or not he's a veteran, whether or not he's served. He should be evaluated as any other citizen. I mean, I don't think he would want special dispensation just because he served, even though that is a very admirable thing. The Constitution, when it comes to speech, applies to everybody globally. So we ask ourselves, what if anybody applied for infidel? Not somebody who's a war hero, but anybody applied for this word that is, I keep saying infidel, but it's, I don't know how to pronounce infidel with a number one. I guess it would be infundel. I don't know how to say it, but that's what was rejected. And that, again, you and I agree, it's entertaining. But is it really what our government should be spending its time litigating? Is this really something that we need? Is it worth? I would love to see the numbers. It's the $30 that Michigan charges its license plate, for these customs license plates. Does it make that money back when you have to litigate something in federal court and more than once?
But is it fair to let these maybe extreme cases spoil the fun for everybody?
Well, look, it's not about spoiling the fun. I mean, it's about. We have a system. This is a government program. This is not, again, you can write whatever you want on the back of your truck. In fact, you can probably get away with writing the F word. You can certainly write infidel. You can write all manner of terrible things on the back of your truck. No one's stopping you from doing that. No one's infringing on your constitutional right of free speech when it comes to whatever you want to put on the back of your Yaris or your AMC Gremlin or whatever it is you're driving. It doesn't matter. You can put now that's an old reference, by the way, AMC Gremlin. It doesn't matter. You can put anything you want on there. The real question is, should the state be involved in taking your money and then sussing out what words it likes and what words it doesn't like? Hey, if it were up to me, put whatever you want on a license plate. I mean, after all, there's a pretty compelling argument that if I'm speeding away from the scene of a crime and my license plate is 09FJL, I mean, you're not going to remember that, but I'm certainly going to remember infidel. I mean, I'm going to remember that easily. So, I mean, there's a good argument for letting people put whatever the heck they want on there. After all, they're already allowed to do it on a truck. But the bottom line is this. The government can't have it both ways. Either they, if they love this $30 that they get from its citizens so much, then they better just let everybody put whatever they want on there, because litigating it can't be a cost-efficient measure. So if they feel like they can't do that, if they feel like they cannot extend their free speech that much, then the alternative is, I guess, you know, look, maybe its time has come. Maybe you don't have a constitutional right to put whatever you want on a license plate. You do have a right to put almost whatever you want on your car. But, I mean, if you want to say it that badly, stencil it on the back of your car. Get an airbrush and go to town.
Danny, we'll leave it there now. Thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate
it. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Danny Savalas, an attorney at Savalas & Wong and a legal analyst for CNN. We've got his piece on Vanity Plates linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
And by the way, Marsha on Facebook says, Wisconsin will have to pry my more cowbell plates out
of my... More cowbell, I believe.
More cowbell plates out of my cold, dead hands. There, case in point, I had to figure it out, but that's the fun. So what about you? Would you get rid of your vanity plates? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's the 1st of October, time for the rollout of healthcare exchanges under the Affordable Care Act. We'll talk with a guest who will break down the ins and outs of the new program.
Also, the University of Wisconsin-Madison was recently ranked as the number 2 party school in the United States by Playboy magazine. And while some people cheer that distinction, others point out some serious problems associated with the college drinking culture. We'll find out what UW-Madison and other colleges are doing to deal with it.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.